The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. We're back from our summer break, modestly refreshed and ready to bring you the best science news and developments from across the globe. This week, the first show of the season is dedicated to the critically acclaimed book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, by the historian Yuval Noah Harari.
The scientific revolution is one of the three big revolutions of history, and it might turn out in the end to be the biggest revolution of all, not only of history, but also of biology.
A hugely ambitious and insightful book, Yuval delves into the scientific research on our species, drawing out fascinating ideas about mankind, including the profound mistake that was the agricultural revolution and the likely creation of new species of humans enabled by the scientific revolution. I started out by asking Yuval, why take on such a big subject as the history of our species?
Because I was really interested in the big questions of history. Questions like whether all the power that we have accumulated has made us any happier. Questions like why men have dominated women in most human societies. And when you pose such big questions, it's really impossible to answer them unless you look at the entire picture together. If you just study, say, England in the 19th century, it won't give you the answers to such big questions.
You break down the rise of humans, and I'm almost reluctant to refer to it as the rise of humans, but the existence of humans, I suppose, mm-hmm. into these four main stages. What are they? How did you hit on those four big phases to focus and to structure the book around?
Oh, it's not really, you know, something unique to this book or my idea. It's quite common among most scholars to agree that the three big revolutions of history are the cognitive revolution, which kind of kick-started history about 70,000 years ago. And then you have the agricultural revolution. Then you have the process of unification of humankind. And finally, you come to the scientific revolution of the last 500 years.
You start off in the book with pre-human, pre-Homo sapiens at least, and you're talking about the other species that are around our forerunners, if you like. And I'm wondering, there's a sense in the book that we've almost tried to ignore their existence or I don't know whether it's intentional or ignorance. What do you think is going on there with in terms of how we see our forerunners?
Well, first of all, they are not all our forerunners. Some of them coexisted with us. We tend to think about ourselves as the only humans. And when we hear that there were previously other humans, we say, okay, we evolved from them. But the situation is actually very different. For most of the period in which humans existed on Earth, there were several different species of humans living simultaneously on the planet, which is very common in many other animals. You have, for example, many species of bears living today simultaneously on the planet. You have grizzly bears and polar bears and black bears and brown bears. So why not have several different species of humans living side by side? And this was the case for 2 million years until about 12,000 years ago. And for us, it sounds very strange for, I think, mainly ideological and religious reasons. We like to think about ourselves as completely unique beings set apart from the animal kingdom without anything resembling us. And it's a very interesting thought experiment to think how would human history have looked like, and especially ideologies and religions and political ideas, if Homo sapiens was not the only surviving human species, what would have happened, for example, if the Neanderthals had managed to survive alongside us? Just try to imagine the Bible with Neanderthals around. Or just try to imagine Marxist ideology with Neanderthals around. Would Marx have urged workers of all species to unite, or only workers of Homo sapiens to unite? These are fascinating questions which we don't really have to answer because our ancestors wiped out all the other species.
Do you think it's quite convenient for us to forget about those, or whether it's more ignorance that a lot of people, our listeners, I'm sure, know all about this, but is it ignorance that people just don't really know about those, or we would rather not remember?
I think we would rather not remember, mainly because it implies that there is a bridge between us and other animals. And over the last 3 or 4 years, there have been amazing scientific discoveries that have brought this to attention of the general public. Most importantly was the Neanderthal Genome Project, completed about 3 or 4 years ago, which shocked the scientific community by revealing that, in fact, up to 4% of the genes, the unique human genes of modern Europeans, are from Neanderthal ancestors, which means that sometime around 30, 40,000 years ago, Neanderthals and Homo sapiens not only had sex, but even had offspring together, which is really a shocking idea to think that we can have sex with an animal from a different species and even have children together. But apparently this is what happened.
You were talking about how we've sort of forgotten these other human species that lived alongside us. And I know later in the book you talk about the possibility of us essentially creating new human species, that where there will be this multitude of humans or human-like sort of forms around. But before we get to that, in the early stages of the book where you're talking about the first Homo sapiens being these very unremarkable apes, if you like, or creatures, or living mid-food chain, and then very quickly, they rise to the top of the food chain. And you talk about there being some calamities happening because of that rapid rise of humans from being in the middle where they're just picking off small animals, eating plants, but being preyed upon themselves to the point where they're suddenly top dog. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in how did we make that leap, but what were the problems that it caused as well?
Well, we made that leap thanks above all to large-scale cooperation. We often look for the advantage of Homo sapiens on the individual level because I want to think that I personally am special, that I'm so much superior to chimpanzees or baboons or elephants or whatever. But the fact is that on the individual level, we are not very remarkable animals. If you put me and a chimpanzee together on a lone island and we had to struggle for survival, I would definitely place my bets on the chimpanzee, not on myself. We are powerful only when we cooperate in large groups, and this is our big advantage. If you put 1,000 chimpanzees and 1,000 sapiens on a lone island, the sapiens will easily win for the simple reason that 1,000 chimpanzees can't cooperate. So large-scale cooperation is the secret of Homo sapiens success. And this had made it not only the top dog in the food chain, but also an ecological serial killer. We have been changing the ecology of the planet and causing the extinction of many, many species of other animals and plants long before the Industrial Revolution. The first time it happened was already about 45,000 years ago when the first sapiens reached Australia and colonized Australia. And within a few thousand years, 95% of all the big animals of Australia became extinct. And the same thing happened again and again later in America, Madagascar, New Zealand, and many other places.
Why do you think, though, it was Homo sapiens that became the cooperators and won out because of that? Was it something biological? Was it something in their environment that they just happened to adopt that gave them that advantage?
As far as we can tell, we don't have any mass cooperation genes. What really enables large-scale human cooperation is on the cultural level. It's the fictions that people invent, stories that we invent and share. And as long as many people believe in the same story, they obey the same rules. They follow the same norms and the same values. The really remarkable ability of Homo sapiens is not to produce tools, but rather it is the ability to talk about things that don't exist at all, anywhere except in our imagination. Other animals also communicate about real things. Even bees can communicate about the location of flowers. And Homo sapiens is unique in being able to talk about imaginary things, such as gods, such as money, such as nations, such as human rights, all these things which are the basis for large-scale human cooperation don't exist anywhere except in the stories which we invent and convince one another to believe in.
How do we know that Neanderthals weren't capable of that as well?
The best evidence we have is actually lack of evidence. For example, the lack of evidence for trade. We have quite firm evidence for trade between different bands of Homo sapiens 30, 40, 50,000 years ago. For example, you find seashells from the Mediterranean in sites deep inside the European continent, say in Hungary or Austria. These seashells were probably exchanged between different bands of Homo sapiens. We don't find anything like that among Neanderthals. And trade necessitates some kind of understanding, some kind of trust between strangers. And this trust, at least in all cases known to us, is based upon common fictions. Maybe 20, 30, 30,000 years ago, this trust was two strangers meet, and they both believe in the same story about the great guardian spirits that protects our tribe and your tribe. So, okay, so I can trust you and we can exchange these seashells for some, I don't know, skins or whatever. And today, this trust manifests itself in our shared belief in money. We have in money and in banks and in all these other created institutions that we invented and that we put so much trust in.
How much of this comes down to our abilities with spoken language and then also on top of that or additional to that written down language?
It all comes down really to language and to the very unique ability of our language to, again, talk about, communicate about things that don't exist at all. Almost all other animals have some kind of communication system, sometimes very sophisticated communication system, but as far as we know, they only communicate about real things, about lions and rivers and mountains and clouds and whatever. We also communicate about imaginary things. And for example, you can never convince a chimpanzee to give you a banana by telling this chimpanzee that, look, after you die, if you give me this banana, you will go to chimpanzee heaven, and there you will receive countless bananas for your good deeds. No chimpanzee will ever believe such a story. But Homo sapiens does tell such stories and believe such stories, and this is why we can go together on crusade, or build a cathedral, or build a hospital, or whatever.
And this is what you talk about in the book as imagined order, correct?
Yes, this is we construct an imaginary order. All other animals are living inside an objective natural order of, again, rivers and winds and the sea and whatever. We also inhabit this objective order, but in addition to that, we construct an imaginary order which exists only in our imagination, an order in which powerful mythical forces like gods and like nations and like corporations are acting. And over time, you see an amazing development in history that the imaginary order, this becomes far more powerful than the objective order. Today in the world, imaginary entities like the European Union or like the Central Bank of England are far more powerful than the River Thames or the River Rhine. They can decide to build a dam and that's it, the river is dammed. And this is the amazing power of humans is actually in their imagination.
It's the creation of these imagined orders, and we'll come to Persia because I really enjoyed seeing Persia appear in your book. Is the creation of those imagined orders self-serving? I mean, the idea as you're describing it, it could be taken by our listeners as being, well, if you create these imagined orders, then it is done to help the species in some way, whereas presumably they're not created with any long-term plan for humanity. They're presumably created out of some self-interest by the people in who put themselves in charge, correct?
Actually, I don't think, in most cases, I don't think it is a cynical manipulation. Mm. I think in the vast majority of cases, successful stories are stories that you yourself believe in them. For example, if we take, again, the Christian church, I think that the vast majority of people who led the church and who spread around this imaginative story of Christianity really believed in the story. They really believed that there is heaven and hell and God and sin and punishment and all that. They weren't trying to fool other people. And the same is true of the nationalist myth of the modern age and of the capitalist myth of today. I'm quite convinced that the majority of bankers and CEO and finance ministers, they truly believe in their deepest heart in money and in the existence of corporations and in all these big story of capitalism. It's not something that they invent in order to fool other people. They are, in a way, maybe also fooling themselves. Mm. But in the process, they're actually enabling billions of people to cooperate very effectively and to construct this amazing economic system which sustains our world.
I mean, a lot of these have come to something you mentioned at the beginning. Male dominance runs through a lot of these structures that are created. Mm-hmm. And is that just, you think, how those people saw the world? It was their genuine view of the world. I mean, now we view ourselves as living in a more equal sort of world, more equal societies, and maybe, you know, more so than they were. But those structures, those imagined orders, you don't think they were intentionally created for suppression of one type over another?
They usually resulted in such hierarchies and exploitation and so forth. But it wasn't like somebody saying to himself, some man saying to himself, I know that I'm really equal to these women, but I want to be more powerful than them, so I will invent some story which will explain it, why I should be superior. I think that in the vast majority of cases, chauvinists really believe that men are superior, and bigots really believe that one race is really superior. It's, if they are fooling anybody, they are fooling themselves. And this is something that actually biologists have researched quite extensively and reached the conclusion that the best way to fool somebody else is first of all to fool yourself. And the best example that they give is falling in love. And they explain that falling in love is a kind of, in order to fool your potential mate, you first of all have to fool yourself that you're really going to stay with this person forever and forever, and then the morning after it passes away. But at the critical moment, you're able to put up a very convincing act that I will stay with you forever, you're the love of my life, because you really believe that in that particular moment.
I love that. Take us through how Peugeot appear in your book, because I think it does help get across this point about imaginary organization structures or whatever.
Okay. So one of the things that I found when I taught this course to students at the Hebrew University is that they had it was very easy for them to grasp the notion that other societies or primitive societies are based on mythology, on legends, on stories about imaginary entities. But when it came to our society, they said, no, our society is different. Our society is based on rationality, on logic, on science, on things that really exist. So I gave them the example of business corporation, business companies. And I took a Peugeot as an example for never mind why. And I ask, what exactly is a corporation? What exactly, for example, is Peugeot? It's one of the biggest car manufacturers in Europe, perhaps in the whole world. It has annual revenues of 50 billion euros. It's really a very powerful force in the world. And when you ask yourself, what is it? So it's obvious that Peugeot is not the vehicles it is producing. You can take all the vehicles and destroy them, and the companies that produces the vehicles won't be harmed. Just the opposite. It will have better markets to produce more cars. So people say maybe the company is the workers. Now also this doesn't work because say all the workers may come together and have a general strike demanding higher wages and the management will become very upset and fire all of them. So you have no more workers, but the company still exists and it can simply hire new workers, no problem. So the workers are not the company. So maybe the managers are the company. But then again, all the managers can go on a plane and fly to China to sign some big important business deal, and on the way the plane crashes, all the managers are killed simultaneously. It doesn't mean that the company disappears. The company is still there. It will simply hire new managers. And in the same way, the stockholders are not the company. You can sell all the stocks to somebody else, and still the company exists. So what is this company, Peugeot? It is an imaginary story. It's a legal fiction. It's a story which we tell one another. How do you actually create a corporation? You have a big ceremony. In the same way that priests and shamans create gods, they tell a story and convince everybody to believe that story. In exactly the same way, lawyers tell legal fictions. Look, we sign these documents and we put on these documents all kinds of spells and curses in a language that nobody can understand except lawyers. And the moment we finish telling the story, a new entity is born, a corporation. And as long as you believe, as long as everybody believes in this story, the story of Peugeot, the story of Google, or the story of Microsoft, they behave as if this entity actually exists. And as long as everybody believes it, it can become extremely powerful. Some of the most powerful forces in the world today are these legal fictions, these corporations.
So a lot of these entities being in existence is what helps sort of unify all these multitudes of Homo sapiens. But before that, we needed the agricultural revolution to get us to such large population numbers. And in the book, you're very down on the agricultural revolution. You don't seem to have seen it as a very, very positive thing. And you make a very compelling case for that this was a trap that we couldn't get out of once we'd realized how it was working out. Take our listeners through what the problem was. Why was it irreversible? What was the problem that we got stuck in there?
Well, first of all, maybe we need to say a few words about why, for most people, it was a negative development. We usually tend to think about agriculture from the viewpoint of the modern affluent West or from the viewpoint of kings and priests and pharaohs for whom agriculture was a good idea. But if you adopt the viewpoint of a simple woman peasant living in the Nile Valley 5,000 years ago in ancient Egypt, then agriculture suddenly looks like a very bad idea because the life of that woman was much harder than the life of her great-great-grandmother, a hunter-gatherer, who lived there, say, 20,000 years ago. The most salient features of why it was a worse life is, first of all, it's much harder work. Our bodies and minds were adapted by millions of years of evolution to life as hunter-gatherers, climbing trees and sniffing in the woods for mushrooms and running after rabbits or whatever. And suddenly, you spend your days digging canals and logging water from the river to water the field and weeding and planting and harvesting and grinding. It's much more difficult work. And it's much more boring work for both the body and the mind.
So why did people start doing it?
Why did people start doing it? There are several theories. I think the best theory is that it was simply a mistake. History is full of mistakes. Some of the biggest revolutions in history are the result of misconceptions and misunderstandings and miscalculations by humans. The main problem is that humans are very good in predicting the short-term consequences of their decisions, but they are often lousy in predicting the long-term consequences of their actions. And we see it not only with the agricultural revolution, but even today, For instance, when people invented email, they thought, wonderful, we'll have much more spare time. Instead of writing these letters and going to the post office and sending them, I can do it in half a minute and that's over. I will have so much more free time. But we all know how this turned out to be. We have far less free time now. So it's roughly the same thing happened with agriculture. In the short term, it looked like a wonderful idea. Within a couple of centuries, it turned out to be a bad idea, but then it was too late to go back. The same way that you can't now come to your boss and say, okay, forget about emails, I don't want to write emails anymore.
One of the interesting things I thought about in your book when you were saying how it was impossible to go back, maybe there was an element of those people by that point not knowing particularly how to go back. Maybe those cultural skills have been lost of how to be a hunter-gatherer. But also you talk about just the sheer numbers of people would have been unsustainable through that kind of lifestyle that a hunter-gatherer in a region, I think you were talking around Jericho, would have supported a certain number. But farming could in total support more people, even though you did end up with more child mortality, more disease and all the rest of it. So these sort of more but weakened and less happy individuals.
Yes, in essence, the agricultural revolutions means that you can have more miserable people. You have more people and they are more miserable. But from an evolutionary perspective, more people is always better. Evolution doesn't care about happiness and suffering. It cares only about survival and reproduction. If you have more copies of a DNA of a particular animal, that's an evolutionary success. And simply, the demographic growth prevented people, even if they wanted to, from going backward, the same way that today we can't go back to the agricultural methods, say, of the 17th century. If we try to do that, then a couple of billion people will die from starvation.
Mm-hmm. You move on in the book to the scientific revolution. I was keen to hear how you think that has really influenced our path.
The scientific revolution is one of the three big revolutions of history, and it might turn out in the end to be the biggest revolution of all, not only of history, but also of biology. Because at present, in the early 21st century, science is starting to give people amazing abilities to reshape life itself. And to move from the old principle of life, which was natural selection, to a completely new principle of intelligent design. After 4 billion years that life on Earth evolved according to natural selection, we might just now be starting a completely new phase, which will be based on intelligent design, with the help of technologies like genetic engineering, like nanotechnology, like direct brain-computer interfaces that can be used for the production or engineering of cyborgs, beings which are half organic, half non-organic.
And you see that as more than just an extension of traditional medicine, whereas traditional medicine will have kept people alive who otherwise would have died. You know, medicine presumably diverts us away from a normal natural selection path, if you like. But you see these new technologies as really giving us some kind of step change in our capabilities of stepping off the sort of evolutionary path and choosing our own direction to some extent.
Yeah, I think medicine is really undergoing a tremendous revolution with far-reaching consequences. If in the 20th century medicine was about healing the sick, in the 21st century, medicine will be mostly about upgrading the healthy, which is a completely different type of project. And it also has some very threatening or dangerous political and social implications, because when you merely try to heal the sick, you have this conception of a human norm of health, and you try to bring everybody to that norm, and this is, in essence, an egalitarian project. But when your main aim is to upgrade the healthy, you are trying to go beyond the norm, and this is, in essence, an elitist project. You can never upgrade everybody at the same time to the same level, because there is always be a new upgrade and a better upgrade, and it's very likely that the rich will be upgraded faster and in more dramatic ways than the poor, and this may lead to a new era of speciation. Just as 70,000 years ago, we had something like 6 different human species, biologically different human species on the planet, in the 21st or 22nd century, we might have again different humans, biologically different humans on the planet, each with very different capabilities and qualities and maybe even desires.
So you see this as going beyond just the technological haves and have-nots, like we have today with a whole bunch of people for Christmas getting iWatches or whatever the Apple Watch is called, and a whole bunch of people not having any Apple products in their lives at all, and that becoming the sort of technological division that's around, maybe a more of a cultural division. But you see this as becoming biological, so that you get genuine speciation.
Yes, I think that, again, in the 19th, 20th century, in like the first industrial revolution, at the center of the first industrial revolution was the production of stuff, of tools, of cars, of vehicles, of weapons, all kinds of tools that we use. But it didn't really change ourselves. The next stage, like the second industrial revolution, at its center will be the production of bodies and minds. Yes, we will continue also to produce and to improve tools and vehicles and weapons and computers and whatnot, but the really big revolution will be the engineering and production of bodies and minds, being able to change and to upgrade the physical abilities of humans and their mental, emotional, and cognitive abilities. And this is a completely different story than having this gadget or that gadget.
Do you see any reason to be optimistic about that? Or is it, it's very easy, I think, you know, a lot of people will hear that and think, well, if the richest are getting and deciding which these upgrades are, then that may skew what the upgrades become and skew what that particular branch of humanity becomes. But do you have any sense of optimism over that, actually, are upgrading humans?
I think that maybe it's too early to think in terms of optimism and pessimism of good and bad. The main thing is to realize that this is happening. A lot of people are convinced that this is an extremely good development. And what should be emphasized, it's not an apocalyptic scenario out of some Hollywood blockbuster. It's not going to happen in one day. And in all likelihood, it's not going to happen in a forceful way. People will be doing it to themselves gradually. We have already began to do it to ourselves. We are already beginning to use all kinds of methods to change our bodies in more and more radical ways. For instance, if you just think about the mushrooming of the psychiatric drugs over the last 20, 30, 40 years, again, without getting into the discussion of whether it's good or bad, just to observe what is happening. If you think, for example, about the educational system, I don't know how it is in the UK, but in Israel, we now have like a quarter of the students in the schools are on Ritalin or some other drug. And if, like 50 years ago, when you thought about reforming education, you thought about reforming the buildings, the teachers, the facilities, the curriculum. Now people have the idea, wait a minute, we can reform the biochemistry of the students. It's far more effective, it's far more powerful. Now again, without getting into is it good, is it bad, just observing, look, this entire new front of reforms, of changes is opening before us.
With all this power that Homo sapiens have kind of accumulated, it's easy to see why people think of us as being this this uniquely exceptional type of human. But Homo erectus lived for 2 million years, and you in the book say that you don't think we're going to last that long. I think you said we'd be lucky to make another 1,000 years, which isn't going to make us anywhere near a million years, let alone 2 million years. Why do you have that pessimism about our own sort of continued existence? Is it that we'll just find a better place to go and become a new species, or are we doomed?
No, I don't think, again, it's not pessimism. Personally, I think that we'll still have grandchildren, but I'm not so sure that our grandchildren will have grandchildren. because I think that we are talking in terms of decades or a few centuries, not in terms of thousands of years. But we are not talking about a catastrophe like a nuclear war, which will wipe everybody off. What we are talking about is a gradual process of upgrading, which you start with Homo sapiens, with you and me, and you start making small changes and then bigger changes, changes either to the DNA with genetic engineering or changes cyborg engineering of adding all kinds of technology, of bionic technologies to the body, until within, say, 100 years or 200 years, you get creatures, you get beings who have completely different physical and cognitive abilities than us, who are more different from us than we are different from Neanderthals. And it will be this gradual process of change. So it's not a catastrophic prophecy. And many people, especially the people who count, especially the scientists, especially the leaders of technological and scientific progress, they think about it as something very positive, that we will solve many of the problems of humanity and we'll be able to live far longer, far healthier, far better lives. I personally still have suspicions about these scenarios, about these predictions, but it should be understood that most of the people who are engaged with this kind of projects think about them in very positive terms. And just last year, 2 years ago, the European Union had a big competition for choosing the leading scientific project of Europe for the next years. And the leading project won a prize or financial assistance of 1 billion euros, an immense sum. And the project that won this competition is called the Human Brain Project. And the aim is to copy a human brain inside a computer with computer chips simulating the circles, the neuronal circles in our brains. And the idea of the people who are leading this project is that once they will have a complete human brain inside a computer, they could, for example, find ways to overcome and heal psychiatric diseases, which are currently beyond our grasp. Now, obviously, if they do succeed, a lot of other things can also be done, but they tend not to think about them very hard. They focus on this idea of curing illnesses, and the rest of the things we'll see in the next few decades if it succeeds or not.
I mean, that project is hugely controversial. I think there can't be many neuroscientists outside of the ones who got the funding who think that project's going to work. And I know there was a letter to the EU signed by hundreds and hundreds of other neuroscientists saying they weren't going to take part in that project because it was unrealistically ambitious. And so I think the expectations may have been sort of rowed back a little bit because people say, you know, we're so far away from understanding a tiny part of the brain, let alone the whole thing, to be able to copy it into silicon, if you like, that it was quite sort of quite an outlandish thing to propose. But it got the money, and so we'll see what happens. Just to finish off, at the very end of your book, after going through this whole history of our species, you say that we've got very little to be proud of. Well, I wonder if that's a little bit harsh, or is it? Do you believe that?
Well, it depends on your perspective. If you adopt an insider's perspective, what have we done for ourselves? Then yes, we've done a great deal. But if you take an outsider's perspective, kind of a cosmic perspective, what did humans do for the rest of the cosmos, for the rest of the planet? Then it's a very gloomy conclusion. I don't think we've done anything positive for anybody except ourselves. So,
so all of the literature and art and science and sport and everything, it is all very self-serving for our species, I suppose. Maybe we need to broaden that out a bit to be more inclusive of other species.
Yeah, I don't think the cows or the chickens or the chimpanzees gained anything from Beethoven or Einstein or from Shakespeare.
The self-centered species. Yeah. Yuval, thanks for joining us on Science Weekly. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too.
Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind is published by Harville Secker in hardback and e-editions.
That's it for this Science Weekly, a shining example of the sapiens' ability to cooperate. From producer Jason Phipps and me, Ian Sample, thanks for listening. We'll be back next Monday with another edition. But remember, for breaking science news day or night, just go to theguardian.com/science. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.